This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I get it. We want to go to the store and buy things and be able to use those things to help our garden be magnificent right away. But a lot of times the things that are already in your yard that you are having hauled off in that green bin, those are the things that we can use because you've been doing such a great job in your yard of not using those toxins that rather than like taking that stuff and putting it in the green bin, we can use it in the garden and make our gardens more magnificent.
As you're spending more time at home and hanging out in the backyard or porch more than usual, are you noticing an urge to plant things? Apparently, you're not alone, as there are multiple reports of a COVID-inspired surge in home gardening. Millions of Americans are rolling up their sleeves and digging into the earth. This week on Sea Change Radio, the second half of our discussion with author and permaculturalist Paul Wheaton. We discuss his unique and innovative approach to growing and cultivating plants, which he outlines in his book, Building a Better World in Your Backyard. He describes ways to enrich your garden soil naturally and affordably, all while reducing your carbon footprint and water usage. I'm joined now again on Sea Change Radio by Paul Wheaton. He is an author and a permaculture expert. Paul, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thanks for having me again.
We spoke last week about rocket mass heaters and things that people need to start thinking about for the winter. But right now, with lockdowns in many states and people staying at home, they've turned towards looking to their front and backyards more than ever before. Why don't we look at some of the variables? I'm thinking of climate and then things like aesthetic beauty versus growing vegetables and also water usage. So maybe you can fill me in on some of the others, and then we can kind of work within that framework.
The largest chapter in the book is how to grow twice as much food with 1/10 the effort. And one of the ways that we reduce the amount of effort that goes into a garden is to eliminate the whole concept of irrigation. I know that probably quite a few of your listeners have attempted to grow a garden in the past, and then they also wanted to go on a trip, or maybe they had to go to a wedding, or they had to go away for 3 to 10 days, and so they turned the watering chore over to a neighbor, and when they came back, their garden was dead. Mm-hmm. And so they paid the neighbor kid to kill their garden. And I want to provide techniques of completely eliminating the need for irrigation. There's a bunch of techniques. And of course, they work better if you're living in an area that has a fair amount of rainfall as it is. But these techniques have been proven to work well in extreme desert conditions. And so I think they're worth exploring. I mean, the number one thing, and we talk about it a fair bit in the book, in that big chapter, is going to be hugel culture. And so we basically take rotting wood and bury it in soil, and then we grow our garden on top of this new mound. I would like to advocate that people do build hugel cultures that are only like a foot tall or 2 feet tall. I advocate that people build their hugel culture beds 7 feet tall. I know that sounds like that's just nuts and crazy for your backyard and everything, but it actually more than doubles your overall growing space for growing food. And on top of that, it's a big step in making it so you don't need nearly as much irrigation. In fact, generally, when you build them that tall, they don't need any irrigation at all. The idea is that the wood that's buried in this mound is going to continue to rot, and it provides parking places for water and nutrients. So much so that you won't need to irrigate anymore. And irrigation is an enormous task out of all of this. Now, the next thing is we're going to advocate a lot of perennial stuff. We're also going to, of course, advocate that organic are better. And then we want to build good, rich soil and then introduce polycultures. So rather than doing what most conventional gardeners do or most conventional farmers do, which is to grow your food in rows, and it's the only thing in that row, we want to grow such diversity that there's a lot of different things all growing next to each other, and they're sharing that root space. Now, this is another technique to help reduce the amount of irrigation that you need, because a lot of plants have very shallow roots, while other plants have rather deep roots. And so those deep-rooted plants will find all that extra water, and then they have a root exudate. So they're going to shed material, which will now be heavy with moisture, and the shallow-rooted plants will be able to get that.
Let's say you took me to a garden store right now, and I said, yeah, I don't want to spend more than, let's say, $100, $200, but I want to make my garden something I'm proud of, and that is also productive, useful, and it has a minimal carbon footprint.
Okay, so before we go to the store, let's build what's called a hugel culture. And so this is soil on wood. And what we're going to do is we're going to lay some wood on the ground and put some soil on it. We'll put some more wood, some more soil, some more wood, some more soil until it's about 7 feet tall. And we might even shape it so that it's a bit of a sun scoop, so it's open to the south. That'll help to extend our season, and we'll be able to grow more there. Then we're going to go to the seed store, and this is the part that you're excited about. Like, we have $100 to $200 that we get to spend at the store for seeds and whatever else. And I think what we want to do is we want to start off with our nitrogen fixers. We just made this new soil on wood thing, and we need a lot of webby roots, a lot of carbon and nitrogen in the soil in order to make a really magnificent soil, so that when we just sneeze seeds onto this, they'll all leap out and produce mountains of food. But to do that, we need rich, wonderful soil. So I want to start off with the nitrogen fixture. So this is going to be peas and beans are your most obvious nitrogen fixtures, but I want to mix in some lupins in there. If we can, I'd really like to find some alfalfa. That might not be at your typical store, your typical hardware store. So you might want to get that over the internet, but there's going to be different kinds of clovers. Around here, a really great one is yellow blossom sweet clover. And so I'm going to get all these nitrogen fixers and soil builders and plant them around. One of the seeds that I like to use is a perennial rye that Sepp Holzer over in Austria, he has bred them for 50 years, and they grow 8.5 feet tall. And it just really builds soil in really awful conditions. And so I'm going to plant some of that as well. I'm going to, my friend who lives next to me, next door to me in Montana, I'll give you a few seeds. So now here's all my soil builders. And then, of course, I want to mix in a few things I might want to eat this year. Maybe some squashes. And personally, I always like to plant some rhubarb. And so I'll put a few rhubarb culms in there. And I think an important one for a lot of hugel culture is going to be sunchokes. You kind of eat it it's a bit like a perennial potato in a way. It looks like sunflowers on the top, but when you dig underneath, it's got these tubers that are, they're kind of a wacky looking potato. Let's call them that. And the great thing is about sunchokes is that they produce more calories per acre than any other known crop. And they tolerate awful conditions. They don't need irrigation. And since they're perennial, they just pump out food year after year after year with no further effort. The next thing I want to do is it's like, let's go ahead and go buy some of your favorite fruit. Let's go buy a few apples, maybe a few apricots and some plums. And we'll eat those, and then we'll take the seeds from those, and we will put those into the hugel culture bed. And so lots of diversity, and we're going to scatter it around willy-nilly, and there won't be any sense to it.
Can you have flowers and succulents on this hugel culture berm as well?
Of course, of course. Now, I think a succulent might not be as happy here because there's going to be so much moisture that other things will easily outcompete it.
I see.
But what we've done is, and then there's a lot of people that find that this particular polyculture aesthetic, they're going to look at it and they're going to say, it looks like it's just a bunch of weeds. And my response to that is, well, first, I know it's beautiful, right? But what we're trying to do in a way is make it so that all of the weeds that grow here are food. They're all recognizable foods.
Like mint is a weed, for example, right?
Exactly. Mint is indeed a weed. Yeah. And it'll take over areas when given a chance. And in fact, the dandelion itself, the poster child for weeds, actually came to the United States as a food crop. So every part of the dandelion is edible. Although I personally choose to not eat the stems. And we could talk about that for an hour. But some people love to eat the stems. They make kind of a spaghetti out of it. But every part of the dandelion is edible. And it was introduced as a food crop. People used to bring their favorite varieties of dandelion with them when they came to the United States. And so some people would swap seeds for dandelion to get a better tasting dandelion. So it's a food crop. It's a big food crop. And if you turn animals loose in a pasture, dandelions are generally one of the first things that they eat. Now, I would say that the blossoms taste quite good. The greens, to me, are a bit on the bitter side. I might mix them into some things, and I wouldn't use just dandelion greens. But if you cook them with oils, it tends to take a lot of that bitter out. And so, in fact, I kind of feel like if you've got an amazing chef, that when an amazing chef does their amazing thing, that they will find the weeds to be more valuable than your garden plants. A chef with a potato and carrots and corn and whatever else is in your regular garden, it seems like they can only go so far with that. But you give them those weeds and you will have something far more amazing to eat. They can do bigger things with the weeds. I could probably spend 4 or 5 hours talking about the different kinds of wild edibles that you'll find when attempting to grow a garden. But mostly what I'm trying to do is to find the things that you already enjoy eating, and let's see if we can do things in a way that they become your weeds. And then once they're your weeds, now you don't need to tend this garden. Food is pumped out year after year after year with no further effort on your part.
Blossoms blooming, heads all empty, I don't care. Soon my baby down by the river, knew she'd have to come up soon for air. Sweet blossom, come on, under the willow, we can have high times if you look fine. We can discover the wonders of nature, rolling in the rushes down by the riverside. Everything delight. delightful. She's got everything I need. Takes the wheel and I've seen the devil. Pays my ticket when I speed.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to author and permaculturist Paul Wheaton. His new book is Building a Better World in Your Backyard. And folks can check out more of Paul's work on permies.com. That's P-E-R-M-I-E-S. So what you're telling me tends to feel more like somebody who has a decent amount of property. A lot of the, for example, you have a chapter in your book about how to get 5 times more garden growth by gardening with animals. And it's very interesting, but for people who live in densely populated areas, maybe you can kind of give us some ways that they can invest in their limited space most effectively.
So I lived in Seattle for a while, and I lived within the city limits. I had an urban lot, and I had a little strip out in front, like between the street and the sidewalk, and a little tiny bit of yard space that was surrounded by trees and brush that were so big that very little light got to the ground. But out on that little strip in front of the house, between the street and the sidewalk, I made some raised bed gardens. They were only about 2.5 feet tall, but I did put some rotten maple on the inside to act as sponges for water and nutrients. I put in rhubarb and sunchokes, and I planted a bunch of tomato plants, and I had a regular garden there. And then I moved away, and as I was like loading the truck to move away, the people that were moving in planted a bunch of flowers. They ripped out what I had planted, and they planted a bunch of flowers. But I kind of laughed to myself because it's like, oh, you're going to try to rip that out. But I'm a permaculturalist. I planted those things to be the future weeds. And so I went back there this last summer. I just happened to be back in Seattle for something else. And I said, you know, we're only like a half a mile away from where I used to live. Can we just drive by there for just a moment? I want to see what the state of this patch is, the state of these gardens that I made. And they're right next to the street, so it's easy to see. And sure enough, the flowers that the woman had planted were all gone, and it was a jungle of food on this little tiny strip of land between the sidewalk and the street. All these things that I had planted to be weeds in the future had indeed remained as weeds. They didn't have any human. It's obvious from looking at it that no one was tending this garden, and it was just still pumping out food.
So a lot of the gardening that is with your school of permaculture focuses more on food production, it sounds like, than aesthetics of a garden. Is that fair to say?
I'm going to say yeah. I do think that there are a lot of beautiful flowering plants that I include in my permaculture gardens. And usually those beautiful flowering plants bring something else to the table. I loved a plant with a lot of crocuses because when early spring is coming around and everything still looks so desolate, the crocus comes up first. And I could have thousands of flowers while everybody else is still under ice. And there's no life yet on their gardens. So I just feel the urge to plant lots and lots of crocuses. I also plant a lot of lupins because the lupins really help to build soil a lot. And, of course, they're a beautiful flower.
It's a soil-building flower, which makes it different than, let's say, roses.
True, yes. And a tomato plant, for example, also has a flower. Almost, you know, all of our plants, all of our food plants have a a flower. I mean, a squash plant has a huge, glorious flower.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any recommendations on irrigation? You mentioned that's one of the limitations that everybody encounters regardless of their climate. I just recently created with a friend and neighbor a gray water system here for our backyard, where we take our washing machine, spill over, and it gets pumped up into our backyard. What are some other ways that people can maximize their water usage?
I think that the number one thing that a person could do, like if you're going to do only one thing to minimize the use of water for irrigation in your garden, I would say the one thing would have to be mulch. So, and mulch can be so many different things. I would say that the best mulch there's ever been has been hay. Unfortunately, almost all the hay that you can find or buy now has basically been poisoned. And so if you put it on your garden, it would kill your garden now. Whereas 50 years ago, there was like nothing better to put on your garden than hay. I would say that another one that is a lot of people don't understand is rocks. Just good old, I mean, the wonderful thing about using rocks as a mulch is that they'll last for hundreds of years. You know, but just if you could just, you know, put rocks next to your plants on the ground, it's amazing how much it helps as a mulch. Many of your kitchen scraps can be used as a kind of a mulch. Maybe some sawdust and wood chips on top of your kitchen scraps out in the garden. The Ruth Stout technique is what I prefer when moving kitchen scraps out to a garden. But it's amazing how you'll put some of the kitchen scraps out there and put a little sawdust over it, and you come back next year and that's the spot that's just loaded with earthworms, and it's just such a black soil. And any seed that comes anywhere near there is going to do so great.
So really concentrating on your soil is just as important, or maybe more important, than where you access your water and how much water you use when you're irrigating.
If you have great soil, your need for irrigation might be reduced by a factor of 10. A good mulch might reduce your need for irrigation by 80%. I think that a lot of places, the cost of water for irrigation has become extremely expensive. And other people want to use less water for the sake of the environment.
Sure, especially in the West, where we're in a, like, California's in a state of desertification slowly but surely. What about commercial mulch, Paul, in terms of its use? It's so cheap. You go to like a Lowe's and you can get a big bag of mulch for $2. Is that not something that you would recommend listeners buy, or is that okay to get?
I would strongly recommend against buying mulch. I mean, there are exceptions. But I kind of feel like in order to teach people how to buy the stuff that's acceptable, I think I'd have to fill a whole book with that. The problem is that there are companies where they have an industrial waste that they need to get rid of, and they're legally required to dispose of it properly. However, there's a bit of a loophole that if it could be used in a mulch or in a fertilizer, that they could push it through those channels. And so basically what we have available to us is oftentimes like the stuff that is an industrial waste tends to be much cheaper than other stuff. And so I would strongly advocate against it. Better to grow your own mulch.
What about to just as a Kickstarter to get things going in your garden? And you back to our little visit to the store. We're a ADD culture, and people like to see results pretty quickly, and that's not really in line with gardening, which requires patience.
I have visited so many gardens where people try to take the shortcut. I have a video up on YouTube where I was visiting Bellingham, Washington, and people were showing me their gardens. And along the way, most of the people that I interviewed, they were showing me the disasters that came from buying compost. And so compost, homemade compost, is this wonderful, magical stuff that does such great things for your garden. And, of course, much like what you're suggesting, these people wanted a quick shortcut. So they bought a few bags, or they may have even bought like a pickup truckload, and they used it, and everything in their garden died. It has to do with how persistent herbicides are so favored these days. And they have a half-life of 7 to 11 years. And they find our way into these compost systems. And but they survive the compost system. And so then they're composted. And then you put the compost on your garden. And then these persistent herbicides do what herbicides are supposed to do, poison plants. And so your garden dies. It's unfortunate. And pretty much every commercial mulch or fertilizer that you can buy today has some of it in it. In which case, I mean, one of the reasons that we try to grow our food at home is to know the quality of it. And once we broach this path, then we're going to be, you know, violating our own standards in that way. And so now you're just right back to, like, why don't you just buy the lower quality food at the grocery store rather than growing your own lower quality food at home? If we want to grow a superior quality food to solve world problems, then we need to recognize that, no, we do not want to buy the industrial waste that's coming through these channels. We're not going to feed that monster and give them that money and approve of what they're attempting to do. I get it. We want to go to the store and buy things and be able to use those things to help our garden be magnificent right away. But a lot of times the things that are already in your yard that you are having hauled off in that green bin, those are the things that we can use because you've been doing such a great job in your yard of not using those toxins, that rather than like taking that stuff and putting it in the green bin, we can use it in the garden and make our gardens more magnificent.
Well, you've given us a ton to think about, and I hope our listeners will act upon your recommendations and build better backyards. His book is called Building a Better World in Your Backyard, Paul Wheaton. Paul, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Mr. Wise.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by James Brown and the Grateful Dead.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.